The death was announced today of Toni Morrison, the American Nobel Prize winning author of novels including The Bluest Eye, Song of Solomon and Beloved, the book which also won her a Pulitzer Prize in 1988. She died yesterday at the age of 88 in hospital in New York City. Morrison was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012 by Barack Obama, who tweeted in reaction to her death, "Toni Morrison was a national treasure, as good a storyteller, as captivating in person as she was on the page. Her writing was a beautiful, meaningful challenge to our conscience and our moral imagination. What a gift to breathe the same air as her, if only for a moment." With me in studio on this Tuesday evening, Anne Enright and poet Paul Muldoon will join us on the phone. I'll speak to both Anne and Paul shortly. But first of all, Toni Morrison's fiction was first published in the 1970s. And before we came to air this evening, I spoke to writer and critic Bonnie Greer. I asked her if Morrison was doing something back in the 1970s that other writers simply weren't doing.
Certainly, because the 70s were a time when we were just coming out of the more, I would say, journalistic school of Black letters because of the Civil Rights Movement, which was really, really journalistic-led and shaped. A lot of the writing had that kind of feel. And so she veered away from that and went into what I call the African continuum, the kind of language and stories that went delved deeply into the African American unconscious and imaginarium, and brought it forward and made it part of the literary landscape immediately.
I read in the New York Times today, they spoke about her prose ringing with the cadences of Black oral tradition. How important is that aspect of her work, do you think?
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, the cadences certainly is right, but other writers did that too. I mean, Baldwin could do that. Richard Wright could do that. Zora Neale Hurston could do that. What they didn't do was do the same thing, if I may say, that James Joyce did, in the fact that she put her people's imaginarium on paper, and she used it and to define the real life of them, so that she literally brought words into the language and thinking into the language that hadn't been there before.
You've spoken there, you've used that word imaginarium a couple of times now, and you've mentioned the African-American unconsciousness. You know, to what extent was she dealing, even though these people and these characters are quite often very real, and in some cases based on historical characters, was she dealing with a kind of a myth around characters rather than any kind of realism?
She was dealing with what we didn't say to the white man. So, in other words, she picked up the language, some of it not even spoken, that we spoke in our own heads and to each other. And she gave it agency by putting it inside of literature and making it literature, not even rendering it literature, because it was literature all along. But she took that unconsciousness and made it into literature.
And how brave was it to do that? Yes, we'd had all of those events of the 1960s and maybe certain barriers had been broken down, but how brave was it to do that in a literary world, in the literary world of that day?
Well, she was an editor.
Yeah.
She's an editor for Random House. So she'd seen, I think I sent something to her when I was a little girl to Random House, because that's the place where you sent stuff. And she probably saw a lot of stuff coming across her desk. And at one point she thought, I can do better than that. I'm sure she did. And she decided to take a leap and put down what she heard in her own head and what she heard that went across African Americans that white people didn't hear, and that sometimes we didn't hear either, because there's language on top of language that you have to use in order to just survive. She stripped it back and she took out the real language that we used amongst ourselves.
And in that time as editor in Random House, she published, her authors included Angela Davis and Muhammad Ali. But I have a quote from her at that time saying that she looks very, these are her words, "I look very hard for Black fiction because I want to participate in developing a canon of Black work." I mean, to a certain extent, was she one of the great beginnings of developing that canon of Black work?
She is the canon. And that's the thing, that's the most important thing to understand. She is the canon. Now, the rest of us are there, and then we have our books, we have our novels, but she's the pace setter, and she'll be that for a long time, because what she did was to hit a moment when African-American writing and African-American life moved away from that journalistic, and you mentioned Angela Davis and Muhammad Ali. These were biographies. Mm. This was prose. She moved away from that and moved into this imaginarium, and she found the words for it, and she knew how to put it down on paper. And that makes her really the canon.
How important is slavery and the legacy of slavery in her work?
Well, she was very aware, and I think what she did give us in this sort of shape that she created, this imaginarium, the new people that we became, I call it the African continuum, those of us who are descended from the enslaved, whether in Europe, whether in the Americas, the Caribbean, we are in many ways a new people, but we're also an old people, and that's the people who have the links with Africa. She understood that we meld this together and are constantly weaving this together, and she was able to step into the middle of it, grab that weave, and begin to make words out of it. 85% of it is unspoken. It's in music, it's in movement, it's in painting, and she was able to find the prose for it. And that's her genius, and that's why she's the canon.
Of the 11 novels, then, that are that canon for you, Bonnie Greer, where would you send those who are not fortunate enough to have read some of her work yet? Where would you get them to start?
I'd start with her first book, The Bluest Eye, because it's so generous, it's so moving. It's about a little girl. It's about children. And you can get into that book and begin to see her generosity and begin to see her heart. And once you get hooked there, then you can step into her world quite easily, because you accepted her conditions of entry. And that's the best place to start.
A sad day for you today, Bonnie Greer.
Well, you know, it's sad, you know, Sean, because of all the craziness that's going on in America right now. But I tell you something, my grandmother, if she was alive today, would say that Miss Morrison passed over in order to do her work on another plane for us. So she's become an ancestor. So on one level, sad, you know, very unhappy to see her go, because 88 isn't of an age anymore. But she's become an ancestor. So now she's able to give us her blessing and to guide us even further in this crazy time that we're in. So mixed feelings.
Bonnie Greer, thanks very much for speaking with us this evening. And that was Bonnie Greer there speaking to me just before we came to air about the death of Toni Morrison, the author who we're remembering in the opening section of Tuesday Night's Arena. As I said, with me in studio here, Anne Enright and poet Paul Muldoon is joining us on the phone from New Jersey in the United States. Anne, you're here complete with three very early Toni Morrison books, in fact, one of which is that very first book, The Bluest Eye, that Bonnie Greer mentioned there.
Yeah, I bought them all in 1 month in 1989, and it was before I knew anything about reviews or writerly reputations. It was in those days when you just went into a bookshop. In this case, it was Books Upstairs, and I found these little export editions of Sula, Tar Baby, The Bluest Eye, and The Song of Solomon. And I came then late to Beloved. Mm. Beloved became a cornerstone for me in terms of learning how to write. So Toni Morrison was one of my great teachers, although she didn't know it.
Yeah, well, what was it about that book, Beloved, then?
I kind of swam in these books for 2 or 3 months, and then when I read Beloved, when I came to write a novel myself, I decided that I would take a book that astonished me, and I didn't know how it had been done, and I would just break it down. And I took the book and worked it paragraph by paragraph and wrote out for my own satisfaction what happened when, how history was interwoven with the present, and how she turned the historical reality into this amazing metaphor, which was the revenant Beloved, the ghost Beloved, who is the ghost of Seth's daughter.
I think I may have managed to transport you right across the Atlantic Ocean very quickly, Paul Muldoon. Just I think it's a message. Maybe your mobile phone is locating you in the United States. You are, in fact, in Ireland. You were in the Gate Theatre on Monday evening, or Sunday evening, rather, and the picnic is happening here at your own picnic. think it's happening here.
I think he bilocates.
But according to Anne Enright, you're bilocating. No, you are here, Paul, in Ireland at the moment, yeah?
I am here in Ireland, but I do think, of course, of New Jersey and Princeton University, where I had the honour of being a colleague of Toni Morrison. And in fact, she came to Princeton in 1989, and her impact there was remarkable. I mean, Anne Enright is talking about what she might teach through her words. And I think what she teaches, not only those who are interested in writing prose fiction, but those of us who are more interested in writing verse. Because on that very first page of Beloved, for example, there is a remarkable image of the handprints in the little piece of cake that have come from beyond, somehow beyond this world, but are absolutely part of this world. And it was Toni Morrison's great gift to be able to make these ideas concrete and to make what might have seemed a little remote, perhaps even a little unreal, real. And as a teacher, she was certainly able to do that. For example, I was chair of the department in which she worked on the day that she won the Nobel Prize. And indeed, in Dublin at one point, she introduced me to an audience as her boss, which is a rather freighted term, if you think about it, given the particular combination that we had with herself and myself. But on the day she won the Nobel Prize, rather than go out to meet journalists, rather than go out and do anything else at all, she met with her class. And that is how I think of her most immediately, as someone totally dedicated to teaching in the immediate sense, and I think beyond. And that's one of the things that strikes me today from what we were hearing from David Greer about what she might teach us in this moment.
Yeah, in fact,
where America.
Go ahead, Paul.
America is run at the moment by a racist.
Yeah, you're not mincing your words on that one.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, I say you're not mincing your words on that one.
I'm not mincing my words, and you know, perhaps I should. And in fact, Toni might teach me something about that too. Maybe there's a way of making a point strongly without being overly vehement. Even so, I think we are in a moment. You mentioned Barack Obama there. We're in a moment where what might have looked 10 years ago like a post-racist America is definitely no longer describable in those terms. And I think we have to... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say to Anne, you were nodding several times when Bonnie Greer was speaking, and one of the moments that I noticed the big nod was when and it's part of what Paul is saying there, I think, as well, that 85% of what she says is unspoken. You know, Paul mentions that image at the beginning of Beloved. It is that thing in the writing of prose, I suppose. It's as much what you don't write down on the page as what you do write down on the page,
isn't it? Yeah, she has marvellous concision and verve, but her career is exemplary in the way it shows us that the person who breaks new ground is often the best. The first is often the best. Mm. And in order to have the energy and wherewithal to enter new territory, you have to be pretty damn good before you step foot in there. And she was just amazing. What I love about her, not just on the page, but in the dryness of her public persona, was her refusal to be complicit in any way with what might be called the man. She could not understand racism. It made her incomprehending and bewildered. She had to, it was a wrench of the imagination for her to try and think what these racists were actually, what was in their heads. She, at all times, refused what might be called white critical culture. She had such disdain for the critic. You know, at one stage, she responded to, I think, a review by saying, "I'm not writing for people like that." And she described herself as writing for black people. And that just, you know, the way she removed herself from a kind of cultural machine that had done her people no good was exemplary, because we all carry that little white male critic in us somewhere, and she got rid of him.
Yeah, and what I think Anne is touching on there as well, Paul, is the fact that you say that on the day of the Nobel Prize winning, she went and spoke to her class. She was both a critical and a commercial success, and I don't mean crassly commercial. People wanted to read her books. What was that quality that meant she could please both, even though, as Anne says, she probably wasn't that concerned with pleasing the former?
Well, I do think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier on, which is the immediacy of her imagery. I mean, she didn't spring fully formed, of course, from her own brow. I mean, she was influenced by a number of writers, including one or two white writers, like Faulkner, for example, Joyce, that we mentioned, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, whom she invited to Princeton under the aegis of a program she started there called the Princeton Atelier, where she had artists involved in collaborative projects come in and work with our students. So I think she had the capacity to touch people. I mean, to the concrete image, no idea but in things, no ideas but in things, is very effective whether one is writing verse or prose, or the poetry that springs from both of those forms.
I think, Anne, you would also talk about her belief in the power of story, and even more than that, the necessity for story.
Yeah, she was so anti-puritanical. There's always a drive pushing writers back into writing just about what they know and just about what they've experienced. And she's quoted as saying to her students in creative writing, why are you just writing about your little lives? Her characters have the wind of history at their backs, and they are, you know, fully and absolutely and entirely human in a historical moment. And so she thought large, as well as grounding it, as Paul rightly says, in things.
And that actually is very important on the literary front at the moment too, where frankly, a lot of people are merely writing out of their quote-unquote little lives. And that one's own life gives one, you know, that's all one needs really to make art. And that's simply not true. And Toni Morrison believed in the idea of freedom from what her ancestors had to suffer, of course, but also the freedom of the imagination, the imaginarium we were hearing about earlier on, where actually you can approach any subject from any angle, ventriloquize any character. And that's something actually that we're in danger of losing just now in the literary world, and indeed beyond.
She saw the necessity of story as well as the wonder of it, and would resist that kind of feeling that making things up is a silly thing to do. I think she thought that making things up brought us further on as human beings in our understanding of the world.
All right. Well, I think we should leave the last words to her. Thank you very much, Paul, for joining us, and best of luck with the rest of the picnic as you travel around the country. I won't send you back to America just yet. And Anne Enright, thanks for coming into studio with us this evening. But I'll finish up with Toni Morrison herself. And this is from June of this year, a documentary about her entitled The Pieces I Am was released, directed by Timothy Greenfield Sanders. And here is Toni Morrison speaking about the lead character in her book, Beloved.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mean that there were no narratives that slave women told, and there was no information about them. I mean, it wasn't the narrative in literature. My effort in saying Beloved, to do that, to talk about a woman who had to make some choices about slavery, about motherhood, about love, about parenting, that had nothing to do with being a victim. A real woman, a historical figure, as a matter of fact, who was anything but a victim. This is a woman who said, these children are mine. No. I can do with them what I want.
Voice of Toni Morrison there from the documentary The Pieces I Am. Toni Morrison's death was announced today. She was 88.